Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. Had some interesting developments today, but we'll talk about that after the chapter. Let's go straight into the chapter. This is Epilogue 1, Chapter 5. Natasha's wedding to Bezukhov. Oh, snap. How do you just go like that? Just say Natasha's wedding to Bezukhov. Which took place in 1813, was the last happy event in the family of the old Rostovs. Count Ilya Rostov died that same year, and as always happens after the father's death, the family group broke up. Ah, great. This is... what? That sentence, that opening little paragraph is just a roller coaster. So they got married. That's great. We didn't get to experience it, though. Come on, Tolstoy, let us go on the marriage trip. Let us go to the wedding. And then we find out that that was the last happy event that happened in the Rostov family. And then we find out that old Ilya Rostov died, the patriarch of the family, dead. And that after his death, the family fell out, drifted apart. Oh, sorry, I'm not meant to do the analysis until the end of the chapter, but come on. That opening couple of sentences is enough for me that's enough for a chapter. That's a chapter's worth of roller coaster. Okay, let's continue. The events of the previous year, the burning of Moscow and the flight from it, the death of Prince Andrew, Natasha's despair, Petya's death, and the old countess's grief, fell blow after blow on the old count's head. He seemed to be unable to understand the meaning of all these events, and bowed his old head in a spiritual sense as if expecting and inviting further blows which would finish him. He seemed now frightened and distraught, and now unnaturally animated and enterprising. The arrangement for Natasha's marriage occupied him for a while. He ordered dinners and suppers and obviously tried to appear cheerful, but his cheerfulness was not infectious, as it wed to be. On the contrary, it evoked the compassion of those who knew and liked him. When Pierre and his wife had left, he grew very quiet and began to complain of depression. A few days later, he fell ill and took to his bed. He realized from the first that he would not get up again, despite the doctor's encouragement. The countess passed a fortnight in an armchair by his pillow, without undressing. Every time she gave him his medicine, he sobbed and silently kissed her hand. On his last day, sobbing, he asked her and his absent son to forgive him for having dissipated their property, that being the chief fault of which he was conscious. After receiving a communion and unction, he quietly died, and the next day a throng of acquaintances who came to pay their last respects to the deceased filled the house rented by the Rostovs. All these acquaintances who had so often dined and danced at his house and had so often laughed at him now said, with a common feeling of self-reproach and emotion, as if justifying themselves, "Well, whatever he may have been, he was a most worthy man. You don't meet such men nowadays, and which of us has not weaknesses of his own?" It was just when the Count's affairs had become so involved that it was impossible to say what would happen if he lived another year that he unexpectedly died. Nicholas was with the Russian army in Paris when the news of his father's death reached him. He at once resigned his commission, and without waiting for it to be accepted, took leave of absence and went to Moscow. The state of the Count's affairs became quite obvious a month after his death, surprising everyone by the immense total of the small debts, the existence of which no one had suspected. The debts amounted to double the value of the property. Friends and relations advised Nicholas to decline the inheritance, but he regarded such a refusal as a slur on his father's memory, which he held sacred, and therefore would not hear of refusing, and accepted the inheritance together with the obligations to pay the debts. The creditors who, restrained by a vague but powerful influence exerted on them while he lived by the Count's careless good nature, had so long been silent, all proceeded to enforce their claims at once. As always happens in such cases, rivalry sprang up as to which should get paid first, and those who, like Mitenka, held promissory notes given them as presents, now became the most exacting creditors. Nicholas was allowed no respite and no peace, and those who had seemed to pity the old man, the cause of their losses, if they were losses, now remorselessly pursued the young heir, who had voluntarily undertaken the debts, and was obviously not guilty of contracting them. Not one of the plans Nicholas tried succeeded. The estate was sold by auction for half its value, and half the debts still remained unpaid. Nicholas accepted 30,000 rubles offered him by his brother-in-law Bezukhov to pay off debts he regarded as genuinely due for value received, and to avoid being imprisoned for the remainder, as the creditors threatened, he re-entered the government service. He could not rejoin the army, where he would have been made colonel at the next vacancy, for his mother now clung to him as her one hold on life. And so, despite his reluctance to remain in Moscow among people who had known him before, and despite his abhorrence of the civil service, he accepted a post in Moscow in that service, doffed the uniform of which he was so fond, and moved with his mother and Sonya to a small house on the Sivstevs Vrashek, which is a poorer quarter of Moscow. Natasha and Pierre were living in Petersburg at the time and had no clear idea of Nicholas's circumstances. Having borrowed money from his brother-in-law, Nicholas tried to hide his wretched condition from him. His position was the more difficult, because with his salary of 1,200 rubles, he had not only to keep himself, his mother and Sonya, but had to shield his mother from knowledge of their poverty. The Countess could not conceive of life without the luxurious conditions she had been wed to from childhood, and, unable to realize how hard it was for her son, kept demanding now a carriage, which they did not keep, to send for a friend, now some expensive article of food for herself, or wine for her son, or money to buy a present as a surprise for Natasha or Sonya or for Nicholas himself. Sonya kept house, attended on her aunt, read to her, put up with her whims and secret ill will, and helped Nicholas to conceal their poverty from the old Countess. Nicholas felt himself irredeemably indebted to Sonya for all she was doing for his mother, and greatly admired her patience and devotion, but tried to keep aloof from her. He seemed in his heart to reproach her for being too perfect, and because there was nothing to reproach her with. She had all that people are valued for, but little that could have made him love her. He felt that the more he valued her, the less he loved her. He had taken her at her word when she wrote giving him his freedom, and now behaved as if all that had passed between them had been long forgotten and could never in any case be renewed. Nicholas's position became worse and worse. The idea of putting something aside out of his salary proved a dream. Not only did he not save anything, but to comply with his mother's demands he even incurred some small debts. He could see no way out of this situation. The idea of marrying some rich woman, which was suggested to him by his female relations, was repugnant to him. The other way out, his mother's death, never entered his head. He wished for nothing and hoped for nothing, and deep in his heart experienced a gloomy and stern satisfaction in an uncomplaining endurance of his position. He tried to avoid his old acquaintances with their commiseration and offensive offers of assistance. He avoided all distraction and recreation, and even at home did nothing but play cards with his mother, pace silently up and down the room, and smoke one pipe after another. He seemed carefully to cherish within himself the gloomy mood which alone enabled him to endure his position. All right. Excuse me. There we go. Another chapter down. Quickly just going to do a little bit of advertising before we go into the discussion. Firstly, Podbean. Podbean is the podcast hosting service that I actually use for this podcast. Podbean, P-O-D-B-E-A-N. Bean like what you would eat. They're offering a month free if you go to podbean.com/ander. 1 month free. So if you're thinking of starting your own podcast, that's the way to do it. Podbean.com. I've been using them for nearly a whole year now and have nothing to complain about. Actually, they've been awesome. I probably shouldn't say this because then everyone will expect this as part of the service. This is them, an example of them going above and beyond. But early in the year, actually it was about March, I used their little online chat support and said, hey, do you know any ways that I could promote the podcast to get a bit of traction, get some new listeners? And they put this podcast as their featured podcast of the week. So it was on the front page. Like if you had the Podbean app and you opened up the app, you'd see A Year of War and Peace. And they also featured it for a whole month on the literature section. So if people are browsing by genre or by by category, A Year of War and Peace was featured in there as well, which was just so cool of them. And they were just really friendly about it. They were sort of like, yeah, we'll help you out. We'll feature your podcast. And my subscribers grew from about, I think it was about 200 at the start of that month to about 1,200 at the end of that month. So that's just an example of the kind of service that you get with Podbean. So I'm a big advocate for Podbean. They've been great to me. If you're thinking of starting your own podcast, podbean.com/ander. It's a great way to do it because they put your podcast in all the different services as well. So I upload my podcast to Podbean and they send it off to iTunes and, Android podcasts, whatever, wherever you are listening to. So it's pretty convenient. Secondly, another advertisement, audible.com. If you're looking for a good audiobook or something to keep listening to after this episode, get yourself Audible. It's the unrivaled library of audiobooks. audibletrial.com/ander. You'll get a free 1 month trial subscription and any audiobook of your choosing. That's audibletrial.com/ander. Alright, thank you very much for your patience there. And let's get into the discussion. Now, the big development I was talking about. The big development. Let me just bring this up on my computer here because this is quite exciting. So, as you know, A Year of War and Peace is wrapping up. And for months now, probably more than 6 months now, we've been talking about what happens next. And I decided I wanted to tackle the Hemingway list. So, it kind of just all fell into place because this list of books that Hemingway wrote... Sorry, he didn't write the books, he wrote the list. I have wanted to read through this list for years, for probably 10 or 15 years. I learned about this list a long, long time ago and just thought it was so cool. Also, Hemingway is one of my favorite authors of all time, and being an author myself, his advice was very important to me, if that makes sense. It was kind of like, I was able to ask the greatest mentor to me, someone I idolize, hey, what should I do to become like you? And he handed down this list. So I've always wanted to tackle this list. Another book, though, that isn't on the list was the one that was voted most popular for the next book among the A Year of War and Peace community, and that was Les Miserables, Les Mis, by Victor Hugo. So, what ended up happening is the community, it looks like, is splitting into three. Firstly, there's the people who are going to reread A Year of War, reread War and Peace. So that is 1/3 of the community. The second chunk is the people who are going to go down the Hemingway list path with us. And thirdly is the people who want to read Les Miserables. Am I even saying that right? Les Miserables? Is that how you say it? And so there is now 3 subreddits. There's the original subreddit, A Year of War and Peace. There's our subreddit, The Hemingway List. And there's A Year of Les Miserables. Did you get all that? Is it too confusing yet? Anyway, somebody, Cutilly, from the Les Miserables subreddit, has popped over to our one and said, "Hey guys, I would be very sad to see the community from A Year of War and Peace split. Seeing there are more people subscribed over at Les Miserables, what do you think about a compromise? My suggestion is this. We freeze this sub for a year, read Les Mis instead, and then return to the Hemingway list in 2020. Now, that's a pretty... I don't know, like, I was kind of touched by this. It was nice, because when I do go and look at the Les Mis subreddit, I see all these familiar names. I see Who Was Once Delight and Cutilly and Chattel Valster and all these people, and I just think, oh, they're there too, and they're there, and I'm like, kind of feel like I'm going to miss these guys, and I don't really want to split up the community. But on the other hand, I've just registered the domain, The Hemingway List, for starters, and I'm also really excited to do The Hemingway List. These are books that I've wanted to read for a long time. I think that goes a long way, to have the host of the podcast and the person who's sort of running the subreddit being excited about the content. I think that boosts the content in quality a lot. So that's another reason why I think I'm going to stick with the path. It's also a bit like I've decided this is what I'm doing. I've announced it a few months ago, and as much as I do actually want to read Les Mis as well, but it's kind of just, I don't know, I just feel like I should do what I said I'm going to do, sort of stick to my guns a little bit. So while I really appreciate the offer of conjoining our two communities, I would say that what we're going to have to do instead is start some kind of gang rivalry between these two groups. So anyone listening to the Hemingway List, I would urge you, if you do run into anyone from the Les Miserables subreddit, to just incite some violence upon them. You could just start with maybe a shove or a push and some mean words about Victor Hugo. I heard that when Victor Hugo died, they shut down the brothels in Paris as a tribute to him, because he was such an avid user of the brothels. So that's maybe some ammunition you could use against those filthy Les Mis readers. So Cutilly and the Les Mis community, I do appreciate your offer, your truce offer, but I'm going to have to respond with physical force, physical violence, and just straight up hostility. So, I look forward to the coming gang wars between us. And another reason why I'm sticking with the Hemingway List, I think, will be clear. You know, yesterday's podcast, I said I had an announcement and that it might be ready for tomorrow's episode. It isn't quite ready today. Tomorrow. It will be tomorrow's episode when I make this big announcement. And when I do, I think at that point it will also reinforce my thinking behind sticking with the Hemingway List. That big announcement is, of course, the first 3 books that we'll be reading on Hemingway's List. And a little extra. That's not all the announcement. I will be announcing the titles, but there is more to this announcement. I'm actually really excited to share it with you guys, but it's just not quite there yet. 24 hours should do it. And actually, it might even be sooner than that. Keep an eye on the subreddit, the Hemingway List subreddit, because if it's ready to announce before tomorrow's podcast, I'll actually announce it on the subreddit first. It's going to be really exciting. All right, now, yep, I was nearly about to wrap up the episode. We haven't even discussed the chapter yet. Okay, so this chapter, oh my gosh, what a heartbreaker. So, here I am. I kind of feel like an asshole. I'm just waiting for them to get married. Like, that's going to solve everything. Get married, guys. Pierre and Natasha. That's the happy ending. And then Tolstoy is just like, yeah, they are married, and now everything sucks. Right? I feel really badly for Nikolai. I feel awful for Sonia. The mother, Countess Rostov, that's just a pitiful thing. I feel so bad for her, and I just don't know what to even say about her. There was that part in the chapter where it hadn't even occurred to Nicholas the other option to get him out of trouble, which was his mother's death. And I was guilty of having thought, oh, if she'd just die, he'd be fine. So what does that say about me? Of course, I don't want her to die. And of course, poor old Count Ilya Rostov, who has pretty much just died of sadness, hasn't he? His world fell apart. His youngest son has died. His daughter's love died, and then she's gone and turned around and getting married to someone else. And he's trying to be happy through the wedding. Trying, but his cheerfulness was met by sort of pity by his own friends. Oh, it's just tragic to watch. So in the chapter where they finally got married, the marriage part of it was little more than a sentence, and the rest of it was tragedy. Filthy, disgusting Victor Hugo loving Redditor, who was once Delight, who I believe is a serial killer, said, "Would anyone like to say a few words on the passing of Count Rostov? On the whole, how did you view his life?" Huh. Yeah, I'll say a couple of things. I really liked Count Rostov because he was one of those characters who... well, his life was hard. Things sucked. And in these stories, you see these heroes who deal with these troubles, right? Always. But he was just sort of slowly crushed by them until he just gave up and went to bed and died. And I don't see that as a failure on his part. I just think life got the better of him and slowly crushed him. And at least he stayed cheerful and tried to keep the people around him cheerful as much as possible. Some people get dealt a bad hand. I mean, he was extremely privileged, so it's funny to say that. But things happened out of his control. His world spiraled out of his control. And I just think he wasn't equipped mentally. I'm not saying he was stupid. I'm just saying he just couldn't keep on top of things. I just think that's really sad. He did his best, but, you know, didn't come out on top. Really awful to see, but I can relate, because a lot of people who you really love in life, in real life, are exactly like that, aren't they? They keep trying, they keep smiling, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to win, because life isn't just like a storybook, is it? Some people try and try and try and eventually fail. That was kind of what happened with Rostov. But failure or not, he was definitely a good man who tried as much as possible to do right by his family. Who was once Delight also disgustingly said, Tolstoy describes Nikolai's feelings towards Sonya by saying it was as if he reproached her for being too perfect and having nothing to be reproached for. He felt that the more he appreciated her, the less he loved her. Why do you think this is? Do you think his feelings are typical and natural of people in general, or more specific to his situation? That was a weird one. Was it some kind of, like, defense mechanism, maybe? Like, he didn't want to feel guilted back into a relationship, perhaps? And so he was sort of pushing back against this perfectness, you know? She's too loving, she's too good. I don't know, maybe something like that. It was a funny one, I didn't quite understand that. And lastly, Who Was Once Delight asked, now that both patriarchs are dead, do you think that Tolstoy intended the Rostov and Bolkonsky families to act as foils for one another? How do these families compare and contrast? You'd like to think that they'd cooperate and strengthen between them, but maybe that's not the case. Who Was Once Delight also said, I wish this hadn't been my chapter to write questions on, as there are so many things going through my mind with the death of Count Rostov. I try to keep my own opinion out of the questions as much as I am able. I can't say I always succeed. No, you do a great job, Who Was Once Delight. I always actually look forward to your comments and your questions. I mean, what am I saying? You're a disgusting Victor Hugo loving fool. You can't deny that the man was a fool and that his actions are ruinous to his son's happiness. For now, I haven't read ahead, but I think Nikolai's future with Mario is so guaranteed that it feels like a spoiler to guess at it. That said, Nikolai's refusal to dishonor his memory by refusing the inheritance, as well as protecting his mother from the reality of their situation, says something about the quality of them as people and parents. Throughout the book, the Rostovs seemed like the only genuinely happy and loving family we encountered. Does that make being obviously the most foolish as well worth it? I don't know. Yeah, it was a tricky thing. I suppose he did the honourable thing. You can't deny him that. He took on the debt and did what needed to be done to pay it. I couldn't help but think that maybe the debt accrued for the same reason that he struggled to pay it, because his mother was so attached to the luxuries. I think his father had the same problem that Nikolai is now having, in that it's impossible to tell Countess Rostov the true situation. And I think if both of them are finding it impossible to tell her, then it's she that might be making it impossible to be told. She's setting these standards and probably has all these defences up against any kind of threat to those standards. So I am actually blaming the Countess for the financial hardship that Nikolai is enduring, as much, at least as much, as Nikolai's father. I think both of his parents are responsible for this problem. Now, I'm sure that the Count had have said to the kids, we're broke, we're going to have to live somewhere smaller and within our means, that would have been fairly easy for him to do. I think the problem was he wasn't able to tell his wife that thing. So I think it's quite, you know, I was a bit dark on the Countess in this chapter, because she's very much turning a blind eye to the problems. Surely in the process of her husband dying and his debts having to be settled, she would have become aware of the fact that the debts were greater than the equity that they had, right? How did she get through all that process without becoming aware of the fact that they're very, very broke? I think it's a willingly turned blind eye on her part. Ninjastro said, honestly, I'm surprised that this is the same Nikolai we're talking about. He did a complete 180, aside from helping Maya that one time, and I won't get into how he only seems to have done it to feel like a man saving a damsel in distress, he wasn't that responsible of a son. Now he's the epitome of honour and dignity. What happened? Wasn't this the same guy that ran away to be in the war rather than settle his own debts for his family? Yeah, that was him. But you know what I was thinking is, I think he's always felt guilty about that gambling debt, right? That he just sort of casually lobbed onto his father. And then you knew in that chapter way back then that it was playing on his conscience, that he felt bad. And now I kind of feel like the reason he took on this debt of his father's is because it's his chance to make amends on that. I really feel like those two events are connected, that gambling debt from way back then factored into why he took on his father's debt. DeFleury said, "I was so happy to leave the history lecture." I'm sorry, I can't read tonight. "I was so happy to leave the history lecture. I read the entire first epilogue. No regrets. I think the Rostovs are the only traditional, complete family in the novel. Worthy of their own TV sitcom. Everyone else seems to be fatherless or motherless. Prince Andrew, Pierre, Boris, Dolokhov, Helena, all of them are missing at least one parent, right? Or at least we never get to know a matched pair of parents, unlike the Rostovs, who even have uncle as a spare. I still despise my translator's clunky prose, but I think Tolstoy's gift is making the characters come alive. They are both fools, but I miss the old Count Rostov, his dancing and his awkward but loving relationship with his family. Because of Tolstoy focusing on many weird, irrelevant little moments of their lives, we know this couple with an intimacy that isn't there with, say, Mr. and Mrs. Weasley, or any of the two-dimensional heroes of The Lord of the Rings. A lot of authors can write characters who are too good to be true. It's rare to find one who makes them so annoying and unpleasantly human, and you end up caring about them in spite of the bad things they did. Haha, just like real parents." Very well said, DeFleury. You know, the Weasley parents are the perfect example of a loving, traditional family, right? But a little too perfect. A little too perfect. I mean, they are flawed. They struggle financially, the Weasleys. And they bicker and they argue, and one of their sons sort of rejects them at some point. So they have their internal squabbles, but it is just slightly too... They're slightly too good, aren't they, Mr. and Mrs. Weasley? Just slightly too good. Whereas the Rostovs, Count and Countess, are spot on with just the right amount of kind of shittiness, right? That good people have. Good people do have a little dose of shittiness about them. Take me, for example. I'm inciting a gang war between two literary book clubs. Who Was Once Delight replied, saying, "Yes, I think it is rare that an author presents characters who are so flawed and who make such profound mistakes, and yet who are still deeply loved by those around them. Comparing them to our real parents is a good point. I'm not sure I often give a character the same consideration I would a person." Yeah, coming out of this, I tell you who I really want to just be okay. I want Nikolai and Maya to get together, and I hope Nikolai is okay. But I just want Sonia to be okay, right? She deserves a bit of a break. She has been just a good person from the start. So I'm not going to get my hopes up though, but I am hoping that something good will come her way by the end of the book. Alright, that is going to do us for today. Thank you very much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow with a special announcement. Bye for now.